Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the November 26th Thanksgiving Eve edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. That today's program comes on Thanksgiving Eve is, of course, a coincidence. At the moment, there isn't much for which the planet can be thankful, but for the moment, with regard to Iran, the administration has managed to keep Washington's war-hungry jackals at bay. Given the midterm election results, however, that it could do so much longer is doubtful. As you have heard by now, the so-called P5 plus one nations, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council and Germany, and Iran have agreed to extend the November 24th deadline for their ongoing talks until July 1st. It marks the second time that both sides have extended the deadline since the conclusion of an interim agreement in January called the Joint Plan of Action. The plan keeps Iran from installing new centrifuges or increasing its stockpile of uranium, neither of which is prohibited under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement to which Iran is a signatory. In both extensions, however, negotiators decided to stick to the goal of achieving a comprehensive agreement that would limit Iran's nuclear activities over the subsequent decade. To talk about the significance of Monday's extension and the reaction to the negotiations both in Iran and the United States, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Jamal Abdi, Policy Director of the National Iranian American Council in Washington. Unlike AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which advocates on behalf of Israel's hardline government, the National Iranian American Council concern is the Iranian American community, and it does not support or purport to represent in any way the Iranian government other than believing that a peaceful relationship between Tehran and Washington benefits both peoples. And Washington, as such, it has been a strong supporter of the ongoing negotiations between the U.S. and its fellow National Security Council members and Iran. How it manages to operate in what I and others have described as Israel's most important occupied territory, Congress and Capitol Hill, is a major challenge and among the topics I'll discuss with him, so stay tuned for that. Upon the announcement of the new deadline for the talks, Israel's Washington ringmaster, AIPAC, wasted no time in going on the attack, saying it was quote-unquote essential for Congress to pass new Iran sanctions now that a deadline for nuclear talks has been extended. Quote, from AIPAC, Congress delayed enacting additional sanctions over the past year to give negotiations a chance. That was a statement on Monday. It is now essential, it says, that Congress take up new bipartisan sanctions legislation to let Tehran know that it will face much more severe pressure if it does not clearly abandon its nuclear weapons program. End quote, the statement read, disregarding the lack of evidence that it has such a program. We urge Congress to play its traditional and critical role to ensure that a final agreement truly eliminates any path for Iran to build a nuclear weapon, went on the AIPAC statement. AIPAC had backed enhanced sanctions earlier in the year, but dropped its active lobbying on their behalf following a powerful speech on the Senate floor by Senator Dianne Feinstein in January, during which she declared that a vote for new sanctions at that time was a vote for war. Feinstein's speech, the most important of her career, stemmed in its tracks the anticipated rush of key Democrats to sign onto the bill, making it clear that the Democratic-led Senate would not allow new sanctions to pass. Those proposed at the time would have only gone into effect if Iran had violated the terms of the agreement governing the talks or had walked away from them, but with the Iranians threatening to withdraw from negotiations should any new sanctions legislation be enacted, Obama and Kerry leaned on fellow Democrats not to support the bill, but it was not until Feinstein's speech that their efforts were successful. Republican leaders, now the majority in the incoming Senate, are already talking about new sanctions, although reaching a filibuster-proof majority would require Democratic support. They have already been promised that by New Jersey's Robert Menendez, who had been a co-sponsor of the previously stymied legislation. Following Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu repeating his opposition to any deal that leaves Iran with any nuclear program on ABC's This Week on Sunday, the Cuban-born Menendez, the top Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, indicated on Monday that he would back new sanctions. The cycle of negotiations, followed by an extension coupled with sanctions relief for Iran, has not succeeded, Menendez said. I continue to believe that the two-track approach of diplomacy and economic pressure that brought Iran to the negotiating table is also the best path forward to achieve a breakthrough, he said. I intend to work with my Senate colleagues in a bipartisan manner in the coming weeks to ensure that Iran comprehends that we will not ever permit it to become a threshold nuclear state. End quote. Illinois Senator Republican Mark Kirk, one of the biggest recipients of pro-Israel campaign funding, who had co-sponsored the stall legislation with Menendez, pledged to revive the new sanctions legislation when the Senate begins its new session in January. One of the power centers on Capitol Hill is the FPI, that's FPI, or Foreign Policy Initiative, that you almost never hear or read about in the mainstream media or hear about on NPR or Democracy Now! Founded by Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan, it builds itself as a successor to PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, a legitimate claim since both were founded by the same pair of neocons. Unlike PNAC, FBI makes no attempt to hide its pro-Israel agenda, especially since Kristol also was the founder of something called the Emergency Committee for Israel. They trust the media not to make the connections, and that trust is not misplaced. Next Wednesday, December 3rd, the FPI will be holding its annual forum in Washington, which, given the clout of its speakers list, should or would attract considerable publicity for the organization if it wanted it. Apparently it doesn't, but we'll tell you who is already on the program. It starts off with a presentation by Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker. He's the new chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and with Fred Hyatt, editorial page editor of the Washington Post, doing the moderating. The topic? Stopping Iran's nuclear ambitions. Before lunch, the attendees will hear from John McCain, the new chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, with Robert Kagan, his former policy advisor, and now Hillary Clinton's foreign policy advisor, doing the moderating. Right after lunch, we'll hear from Robert Ford and James Jeffrey, former ambassadors to Syria and Iraq, respectively, speaking about the Middle East in chaos, which just happened to be a longtime neocon objective. That will be moderated by Kimberly Kagan, president of the Institute for the Study of War and wife of Fred Kagan, who you might recall was the author of The Surge, which produced America's glorious victory in Iraq, until it didn't. Then in the afternoon, they'll hear from two presidential aspirants, Senator Ted Cruz, a Joe McCarthy imitation from Texas via Cuba, without Senator Joe's 5 o'clock shadow, and Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. They'll be speaking about America's role in a changing world and rebuilding the American defense consensus, respectively, about which both of these men have shown themselves to be totally clueless. That seems to be a requirement for anyone who has hopes of getting into the White House. The Foreign Policy Initiative was quick to issue a position paper on the decision to extend the Iran nuclear negotiations, accusing Iran of exploiting the situation, and the White House to turn the decision-making over to Congress. End quote. Although the president said he would be, quote, the first to call for more sanctions in the event of Iranian intransigence, said the FBI paper, that responsibility has instead fallen to the legislative branch, which has offered dozens of proposals despite opposition from the White House. End quote. That this ignores the limitations on Congress's role as defined by the Constitution is apparently irrelevant to the statements listed authors, Executive Director of the FPI, Christopher Griffin, and Senior Policy Analyst Zvi Khan. Their paper notes that, quote, incoming Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will likely allow a sanctions bill to receive a vote on the Senate floor, while growing Democratic skepticism over the talks may enable the, quote, unquote, Nuclear Weapon-Free Iran Act or similar legislation to attain a veto-proof majority. Under such circumstances, they say, the Obama administration's current strategy will prove unsustainable. It will need to negotiate not only with Iran, but with Congress as well. Rather than fight this new reality, they advise, President Obama should seize the opportunity it presents. He should announce that he will seek the passage of new sanctions in waiting in legislation as quickly as possible, and that Tehran must make meaningful concessions on a nuclear program if it wants to avoid an economic catastrophe. If both the president and Congress reads the FBI statement, make clear that the latest extension will constitute the final one. They will demonstrate their resolve to achieve what each say is their shared objectives, preventing Iran from attaining a nuclear weapons capability, end quote. Here, the foreign policy initiative deliberately distorts the president's position, presenting Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's position as if it was Obama's. It is not Obama's stance that Iran would not have nuclear weapons capability, but that it would not build a nuclear weapon. I use the term deliberately because this is a deception that pro-Israel agents in Congress and elsewhere keep repeating. Today, by coincidence, was a deadline of a federal judge gave to the Department of Defense to respond to the demand by Frequent Takes on the World guest Grant Smith that it make public documents that reveal the contributions of American Jewish nonprofit organizations to Israel's nuclear program, a subject that is totally taboo when discussing Iran's nuclear program. Smith, director of the Institute for Research in Middle Eastern Policy, or IRMEP, has challenged the Department of Defense in federal court over its ignoring and denying Freedom of Information Act request for a 386-page report detailing how Israeli organizations, most notably Technion, lavishly funded by American tax-exempt charities, have secretly worked to develop Israel's nuclear weapons program and delivery systems. The Department of Defense has claimed that, quote, perpetual non-disclosure agreements, end quote, prohibit release of the report. IRMEP countered that this was merely Pentagon sock puppetry and urged the court to personally review and directly release the report, since the secrecy has served to defraud American taxpayers of $86 billion that went to Israel in violation of the Symington and Glenn Amendments to the U.S. Foreign Aid Act. Since 2003, Technion has received tax-exempt funding from U.S. donors averaging $87 million annually, despite the fact that overseas nuclear weapons programs and espionage against U.S. facilities do not fit any IRS definition of, quote-unquote, a social welfare charity. Well, the resignation of Chuck Hagel, the Secretary of War, which was what the job was called from 1789 until it was rebranded as defense in 1949, it raised a number of questions that fall into the category of did he jump or was he pushed, which I'll not attempt to get into today, although the latter seems to be the majority opinion. It should be noted, however, that it comes in the wake of greater currency being given to the notion of putting more American boots on the ground in Iraq and perhaps Syria, beyond the additional 1,500 that have just been authorized, and enlarging instead of ending the U.S. combat role in Afghanistan. This includes the resuming of the controversial nighttime raids on homes of men suspected of being Taliban, Haqqani, or al-Qaeda leaders that invariably has led to scores of civilian deaths and vigorous demands that such raids be ended by the now-departed Afghan president, Hamid Karzai. Karzai has apparently been replaced by a Washington marionette. As New York Times reported Sunday, the government of the new Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, has quietly lifted the ban on night raids by special forces troops that his predecessor had imposed. Afghan National Army Special Forces units are planning to resume the raids in 2015, and in some cases, according to the Times, they will include members of American Special Operations Unit in an advisory role. We know all about that. That news comes after published accounts of an order by President Obama to allow the American military to continue some limited combat operations in 2015. That order allows for the sort of air support necessary for successful night raids. A Western military official speaking to the Times on the condition of anonymity said that the Afghan forces would take the lead. He was quoted as saying, quote, night operations are something the Afghans will be doing in a much more targeted way, the way they were trained to do, but were held back under Karzai. We're not going to be doing that, he said, but there are going to be training missions with advisors along. They are not going to go onto the target with the Afghans, but they may go along in some cases and stay back, end quote. Yeah. As a number of successful attacks against Afghan forces by the Taliban against both military and civilian targets have increased since American forces began withdrawing, the likelihood of a Vietnam-like scenario occurring in Kabul after the last U.S. troops depart has obviously given Obama second thoughts. He will let his successor make the hard choices as that war drags on into 2017. I'll conclude with some thoughts from another war zone, the relatively impoverished ghettos and barrios of America's cities and towns, such as in Ferguson, Missouri, where predominantly white police forces are seen for what they are, an occupying army. The motto emblazed across the doors of police cars across America, quote, to protect and to serve, does not refer to the inhabitants of the ghettos and barrios, but to the power structures of those cities and towns and to those who own the largest chunks of property. For black and brown Americans, particularly the youth of those communities, the sight of a police car in their rearview mirror while they are driving or simply walking on the street is not one of reassurance but one of fear, fear of being stopped and jacked up simply for being black or brown. I speak from some experience. Over the years, living and working for a newspaper in downtown Los Angeles, the old First LA Examiner, while attending college, and then later as a photographer in the Bay Area, I witnessed more instances of unwarranted police repression and violence than I could possibly count. In several instances, my photographs were what kept people falsely accused of resisting arrest from going to prison, which brings me to Ferguson and the notion of justice in America. It's mostly a cruel joke for those who are black and brown. Start with the last six words of the Pledge of Allegiance. In their classrooms, when they come to, quote, with liberty and justice for all, unquote, long before high school, they know those concepts don't apply to them. In some ghetto or barrio schools, unless coerced, certain teachers and many students refuse to take part in the charade. Starting in the mid-60s with the Black Panthers and then with the Brown Berets in the Chicano community, young black and brown teenagers and others in their early 20s began to organize politically to radically confront the police violence directed against them. Political resistance was beginning to replace the various forms of self-destructive behavior that prevailed in the ghettos, and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover believed it was becoming contagious. Cooperation across ethnic lines was starting to replace gang warfare as increasing numbers of black, brown, and Asian youth came to recognize that what they had in common was more important than what kept them apart. The government saw this as a threat to the established order, and the result was the FBI's COINTEL program, which was designed to sow divisions within the various organizations while assassinating their leaders. It succeeded, and the same type of program was used in the prisons to destroy the radical movement that was emerging within their walls. This required the introduction of drugs into the prisons in unprecedented amounts. The rivalries and the attendant violence returned while the prisoners who had become radicalized while behind bars and refused to play the government's games were locked away for what has amounted to life sentence. That's just part of the context in which the events in Ferguson need to be viewed.